Notice the word caution in the title. That's because I'm going to be talking about inbreeding, not in itself, but the implications that inbreeding has or may have for the kind of policy regulations that are being discussed in this workshop and elsewhere, biosecurity and other policy regulations. And it seems to me that these implications are not good. So if you'll allow me to, just as an initial and provisional assumption for this talk, allow me to say that inbreeding is likely to be widespread, is already widespread, and is likely to be growing. And if that is the case, what effect is this going to have on the disease problems that we have now in the future? I want to make it clear just exactly what happens to a farm where the stock gets inbred. And the clearest example that I know of is a study by Goyar et al. On Stylorostris in New Caledonia. And the data that I put here are rescaled and redrawn from figure 8 of their 2008 paper. Now, the Stylies in New Caledonia had been 35 generations in cultivation and were known to be highly inbred. And they were also, in recent generations, suffering severe mortality from at least two species or strains of Vibrio. So they thought, well, maybe the inbreeding is contributing to these mortality losses. So they brought in another strain, which was also inbred, from Hawaii, an SPF strain of Pinus stylorostris from Hawaii, and hybridized the two. So then they had two groups of animals to work with, the hybrids, which are non-inbred at the in the generation, the hybrid generation, and two pure strains, which were highly inbred. And they grew these animals together in ponds and cages in the open environment, where they were subjected to the ordinary sources of mortality, including the bacterial mortality, and were also challenged with Vibrio, to see what effect of inbreeding might have. And here are the results. The result depended on how good or bad the environment is. The x-axis is a measure of environmental quality. On the far right hand, the environmental quality is 1. That just means that the survival rate was the highest that they observed during those 2 years of experiment. And everything else is measured by that. On the left-hand end of the x-axis, environmental quality is 0.5. That means that survival was only half of what the maximum they observed. So everything is measured relative to the real performance of the best available environment. And as the environment deteriorates, as measured by survival, then you go from 10 to 9 to 8 to 7 to 5. Now, performance, yield or survival, is the performance of the non-inbred animals relative to the inbreds. So on the left, if you look at the biomass yield, you see 2.4 up at the left-hand end. That means that the total yield of the non-inbreds was about 2.5 times higher when survival was approximately half of its optimum, half of its maximum. I'm just going to concentrate on survival, though, and I have to go over here and wave my hands. In the best environment, the inbreds were only about 10% lower in survival. But when the environment had deteriorated to the point that survival was only half, then survival was 70% higher in the inbreds. The inbred animals had lost, were 70%, surviving 70% worse than the outbreds. And in real terms, that means that there was hardly any survival. So the take-home message from this example is that the effect of inbreeding depends on the environment. And as the environment gets bad, the effect of inbreeding gets more serious. Inbreeding makes a bad situation worse. inbreeding intensifies or amplifies mortality from all kinds of stresses, including disease stresses. Inbreeding is an amplifier of environmental and disease and other kinds of problems. Now, the other important point here is that that curve is not straight. The inbreeding effect between 1 and 0.9, if you look at the red curve, the slope there, is much lower than the inbreeding effect between 0.6 and 0.5. It's nonlinear. The effect of inbreeding accelerates as the environment deteriorates. This gives rise potentially to a threshold effect, which can be pretty serious. So just to summarize this, the effect of inbreeding is to amplify problems. And that has turned out to be true for all kinds of plants and animals, including humans. Now I'm going to begin to put inbreeding, again, I'm just going to suppose that inbreeding is widespread, put it in the context of the regulatory scheme. And on the left, I have biosecurity regulations. By that, I mean all kinds of things that are talked about here. Restrictions to SPF, transboundary limitations, quarantine regulations, all kinds of things like that, bundled together as a variable just called biosecurity regulations. And on the right, disease incidents. I'm not just talking about incidents in the technical sense, but also the prevalence of the disease, the virulence of disease, and so on. Let's call it disease incidents. Now, this is a path analysis. It has some formal properties. It's called structural modeling or confirmatory factor analysis by mathematicians. The way it works is that suppose an external event happens, the emergence of a new disease or environmental deterioration because of climate change or something like this, so a disease incident goes up. What happens? People become anxious. The causal path I've called fear, which is also a technical word, which means if you don't do something about the problem, I'm going to go bankrupt. So disease incidence goes up, and there's an increase in biosecurity activity, biosecurity regulations. And as a result of that, the main purpose of the biosecurity is to reduce the chance that the pathogen gets on the farm. It has other things, but basically that's the objective, to separate the farm from the pathogens. So disease incidence goes up, biosecurity regulations go up, exposure to pathogens goes down, and disease incidence goes down, so the system is stabilizing. That's a stable causal pathway. Any engineering will say that what will happen there is that we would expect there to be a kind of an average disease incidence that fluctuates around some level and an average intensity of biosecurity regulations that fluctuates around some level. And if something happens, like a new disease, it'll come back to that after a while. Now, I've emphasized expected because a model like this, it does give a predictable result, but only if the model is complete. If there is something else, some other connection between biosecurity regulations and disease incidence, then our expectations are off. It's not necessarily going to stabilize. So here's the causal path involving inbreeding, which very few people are talking about, if any, except I started to talk about it. Here, when disease incidence goes up, people become worried, biosecurity regulations goes up, and from a genetics point of view, what these biosecurity regulations are doing is limiting the size of the gene pool, limiting the effective population number, and increasing the rate of inbreeding. A regulation that prevents importation of stock into a country means that country is stuck with the brood stock that it has. Limitation to SPF. The SPF stocks are very limited diversity. So far as I know, there are very few, if any, new stocks being developed. Diversity is going down. If you have a restriction to SPF, then you're stuck with the brood stock you have, and it's going to get more and more genetically uniform. And also, as biosecurity regulations goes up, the value of an SPF stock goes up, so it encourages breeders to use breeder locks to protect their intellectual property. And the way that works is to inflict inbreeding on anybody who copies. So here, disease incident goes up, biosecurity goes up, inbreeding goes up, and by the example that I showed you in New Caledonia, susceptibility goes up. When susceptibility goes up, disease incident goes up. So you've got higher and higher and higher. You've got a positive feedback loop, runaway feedback, which ends in either a buzz or the destruction of the self-destruction of the system, which in this case, I guess, would be the end of open water shrimp culture. I'm going to skip this slide just a little because there's a limited time. It just showed how the breeder lock system works. Now, which of these paths is dominant? They add together. The blue path is the one that we expect, the regulations expect. It's stabilizing. Disease incidence increases biosecurity, which reduces exposure, and it stabilizes. The red path is the positive path. Now, those figures, 70-30, NACA had a workshop November in Bangkok. Some time was devoted to this issue, and the consensus of the people at that meeting was that no more than 30% of the PLs that are being grown on farms are coming through the blue channel, that is, that are exposed to the benefits of regulation, are exposed to SPF, the benefits of SPF, and so on. 70%, if possibly more, are outside the system, are copies, are in the environment exposed, are no longer SPF. They are not exposed to the benefits of the regulatory system, but they are exposed to the indirect, negative, detrimental consequences of the inbreeding channel. 30-70, plus the non-linearity, which means that even if the system is stable, it's a temporary stability because a particularly strong perturbation, a particularly severe disease, can knock the thing into the left-hand side of the graph where you've got the acceleration. It can destabilize it and precipitate a runaway feedback so that even if it appears to be stable for a while, it may be an illusory stability. 70-30, I don't know whether to believe that or not, but it's reason for caution. Now, why have we not noticed this before? Why is nobody talking about it? I think that there are two reasons. One of them is just that we're focusing on the regulations, the benefits of the regulations, and ignoring the fact that possibly a considerable majority of the PLs are outside the regulatory system at all. We're imposing regulations without thinking, what are the consequences of those regulations for the people who break the rules? And those consequences may be pretty severe. The regulations are not designed to take the rule breakers into account, which is pretty unsophisticated of us. Because in any well-managed economy, the design of rules has to take into account the fact that people are going to be breaking the rules. I think we've ignored that. So that's the first. It's essentially arrogance, thinking that our rules are more important than they actually are. And the second is technical. We haven't actually been estimating inbreeding correctly. I mean, this may come as a shock to you. We're not geneticists, but we simply haven't. People using microsatellites to estimate inbreeding frequently say we find no evidence of inbreeding. What they should be saying is that inbreeding has not been estimated. This is a technical point. I don't want to go into it. I don't know why it's been ignored, because it's been known, believe it or not, since 1927, that the main estimator, FIS, does not estimate the kind of inbreeding that gives rise to inbreeding depression. I've just published a paper on this, which is available online in aquaculture research, which includes some of the math. It includes lots of examples of inbreeding and some other stuff. But I just want to show you an example. This is just a simple simulation that I knocked together for this proposal. It shows in the blue bars the accumulation of inbreeding in a small population, just a kind of a small population that any hatchery might have, carried on for many generations. Generation after generation after generation, the blue bars are going up, showing that inbreeding is going up, and the depressive effect of inbreeding is going up. The hatched bars are the ordinary estimators that are widely reported, FIS. And you can see that if you look at the hatched bars, they are paying no attention at all to the real rate of accumulation of inbreeding. So the reasons why inbreeding is perhaps not talked about very much is our preoccupation with the rules rather than the people who break the rules, and the fact that we have not been estimating inbreeding correctly, which is not to say that it can't be estimated correctly, because it can. So what can be done about this? This whole model is analyzable, but basically what we need to do is to reduce the strength of that indirect, horizontal indirect pathway. Reduce the strength of the indirect amplification of disease through the inbreeding channel, or even reduce its size. So there are various ways of tweaking the regulations so that the regulations do not indirectly or directly encourage copying. Doing some things to prevent the consequences of copying, providing it from all sorts. There are various ways of minimizing this path or making it negative. I really don't have any time, so I'll just leave that as homework, how to do that. And there are other things which are not regulated at all, like probiotics that are talked about a lot, the direct selection for disease resistance that Greg was talking about. These things can be done. Although when you think of direct selection, then you realize there's actually a negative pathway leading from regulations. If you insist on SPF, then selection is being forced to be extremely inefficient. And Dr. Wang talked about that, the advantage of mass selection. You lose that completely if you have to use SPF stocks. So there's a negative pathway here. So the whole thing is a mess. I think we need to be cautious about the effect of inbreeding when we're designing regulations. And I'll just leave it here. Thank you very much.